This is Martin Ballard. Radio
Leicester. Well, a very good afternoon. Welcome back to the final hour of the programme today on 104.9 FM. And my final guest is the lady who lived in Germany under Hitler, fled from the advancing Russians, received very little help or compassion in neutral Switzerland, and then eventually made her home in England. She is Helga Gerhardy, and she's joining me in the studio this afternoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Did I first of all pronounce your name correctly?
Well, I make it a soft G, Gerhardy.
Gerhardy.
But it doesn't matter.
Now, what we're looking at actually today is the continuing story, because this is the second book that you've written about your life. But in the first book, your life as it did started in Germany, didn't it? Tell us about the early years for you.
Well, I grew up under Hitler, but I wasn't German, I was Swiss. And of course, I've made a slight difference. I think the first time I noticed it was when Hitler came to power, because then my father not going, he didn't vote. And of course, was that there, everybody called me a communist, because only the communists didn't vote. Mm. But we didn't suffer anything really until the war broke out. Until then, we were neutral, and my father had a dairy business, which was fine. But of course, he didn't go into the war, because being Swiss, you don't have to. And I never joined the Hitler Youth either. But once the war started, I think particularly the SS became rather conscious that there were some people who got extra petrol, because my father had to travel to his dairy. So they started to come and search the house. Usually my father wasn't there, because he only came home for the weekend. It was a rather long trip for his journey to the dairy, and it was my mother who had to cope with it, and she found that very difficult, because they weren't kind at all. They used to open the cupboards and just throw everything out. They were looking for incriminating papers or ammunition or something like that. The war years weren't too bad for us at first, because, like I said, my father having a dairy, when you have extra butter and cheese, you can. My mother became quite good on the black market, start exchanging things. But when the war against Russia started, with us living in the East, we started to get worried, because that was more or less on our front door, which wasn't easy to accept. I was at school, I had boyfriends from the grammar school, and they used to have to leave already when they were 17 years old to go into the army or the Air Force. And I had some I was very fond of, and used to write to them, and I'm afraid one after another one just got killed.
What was it like for a young girl though, growing up at that time when Germany was suffering so many changes, and with war and with the prospect of the Russians invading your part of Germany? How did you feel? Were you frightened by it all?
No, I don't think so. Not until the moment when the war against Russia started. You see, the Russians never bombed us in the East. It was the Americans and the English who bombed the western part of Germany, so we didn't get that bombing. Mm. We even got evacuees from the west of Germany, because it was safer to live right up in East Prussia near the Lithuanian border. I mean, you know, the planes didn't go as far as that. But we did have our first bombing in 1944. The English did make it. And I too was buried in an aerial shelter for 4 hours, and it was the same as people had in London. You know, by the time I got out of the aerial shelter, I'm afraid the months in the back suffocated, and we had a very big mass grave for 63 people, and of course a lot of them I knew from our neighbourhood. So that's when the suffering came. But the real suffering, of course, for me, came when the Russians eventually pushed the Germans back and entered East Prussia. I was a medical student at the time. We had to stop our studies and concentrate completely on the care of the wounded, which used to arrive from the front, only put into cattle trucks. Mm. Because there was no other transport. They were just laying on hay. And in the winter of 1944-45, to get these wounded as far as Königsberg, where we lived, well, most of them were already dead when they arrived, because they were frozen. We had 10 to 15 degrees below zero. The Russians eventually reached Königsberg, but they didn't take it, and I think they thought it had more soldiers there than it really did. I left in January, beginning of January, Königsberg, and became a so-called refugee. At that particular moment when I left, there was my whole family was scattered. My brother was evacuated with his school, so was my mother. We hadn't heard from my father for a long time. So I had to leave on my own. And I just joined one of the refugee tracks. I dressed myself as warmly as I could. I had a sleigh with a satchel on it, and with a suitcase on it, and I had a satchel and I had a rucksack. But it was so bitter cold. And you just joined these tracks. And my first book, Helga, I do describe this journey, which was tremendous because of the walking we had to do and not finding any shelter at night. Sometimes we find a barn, but you see, most farmers had already left, so there was no food either. And many nights one huddled just behind the cart, because the people who were on farms, at least they could take horses in the cart and try and put some of their belongings on there, and even some food. But nobody shared. Nobody knew how long they would have to let their food last.
So how long did it take you to get from Germany then to Switzerland?
Oh, I didn't go to Switzerland then. I just only had this refugee track, which took about 6 weeks. And by the time I finished with it, I got as far as Greifswald. And there I absolutely collapsed. The war wasn't finished. And I was taken into hospital. I was very ill. I had pneumonia. And when I sort of gradually recovered, the nurse apologized and said they had to burn my clothes because I hadn't taken them off for all those weeks. They had to cut my hair because it was matted. But I did find my mother in Greifswald, which was one consolation. But I was still afraid that the Russians would even come as far as that, and we decided to go to Hamburg. We never made it to Hamburg, because I'm afraid this time it were the Spitfires that shot at us. But we were able to jump off the lorry and save one suitcase and finished up at a local farm. I had already, years ago, learned how to milk cows. And because I could do that, the farmer's wife kept us, because I could now help on the farm, and we stayed there until the war finished in May. Then I went to Hamburg to register with the Swiss Embassy and also with the Red Cross, because you could register with the Red Cross if you were missing relatives. And I wanted to register that I was missing my father and my brother and one sister. And it was a miracle that I found my father in Hamburg. He still had his car, actually, but he wasn't allowed to drive it. So he had done something to the motor, because, you see, if he drove it, it would be confiscated by the occupation forces. We were able to, or we hoped to, bring this car back to the farm where my mother and I were staying. So to get it out of Hamburg, he bought an old horse. And there's a very nice picture of this old horse in my first book, how this horse pulled this car out of Hamburg. But we only got as far as a little village called Kiesdorf, and the burgomaster or mayor there recommended that we made our home on a desolate radio station. There were some barracks, he said, and there'd probably be some furniture there and things like that. But I'm afraid it was empty. Everybody already taken everything out. But the British occupation forces helped us to get some palliasses and some cups and saucers. Didn't have saucers, we had mugs and some saucepans, and my father chopped some wood because there was a big stove in the kitchen. We had a well in the front and a little shed in the back with a bucket and a piece of wood on the top for our toilet. And we stayed there. Well, I did, after that, a second journey. And this time my father sold the horse and I had a bike. And my mother's idea was that I ought to make a trip to the south of Germany to find my older sister who was married there. Because after the war, there was no post and no trains in Germany. So if you wanted any news, you had to either walk there or try and get a lift. But I made this journey. At least there was no war anymore, and it was summertime. But all concentration camps and prisons had been opened up, and the roads were full of people who were trying to get back to their own countries, like to Poland and even to Russia, Hungary. I mean, all these people had worked during the war in Germany by force, and now they were making their way back, and I was a young girl of 20. So I had to try and avoid the big roads. I did the small roads. I slept in haystacks, and I slept in farms. I was even imprisoned, and that was by the Americans, because I was on the road after curfew. Mm. But I met a very nice American sergeant who helped me quite a bit. He mended my bike, and I think I fell in love a little bit. He had lovely, beautiful brown eyes, but nothing came of it. I found my sister, who was expecting a baby. Her husband had been taken away by the SS 2 days before the end of the war. She had no news from him, and I like to add that she never did. He just disappeared. So I brought her back to the radio station with my other sister, because she had made her way there too. And eventually she had her baby in that very bad winter of 45-46 on this radio station in these very primitive conditions. But in the spring, we were able to, the embassy, Swiss embassy, had by then got proof that we were Swiss. We got Swiss passport, and we got food parcels, which of course helped us. Mm. And in the autumn, we went back to Switzerland.
And that was the beginning of another epic
that
time
was the
for
end,
you, wasn't it?
Yes, mm. Yes. Now, that's as far as my first book goes. And because I stopped it there, I got a lot of fan mail, and people kept on saying, all right, you went back to Switzerland, but what happened next? Mm. How could you write a book in English? You must have learned English somewhere. So my second book, which is called Helga, the Continuing Story, continues where I left off.
You weren't particularly, well, made very welcome, actually, in Switzerland, really, were you?
No, I'm afraid we weren't. And that's for the first time I was in a camp where even the gates were closed. I never had that in Germany. I mean, we lived on the radio station. We weren't going into a refugee camp. But as soon as we got to Switzerland, that's the first thing they did to us, to put us into quarantine. They were afraid we might bring in some kind of disease and insisted that we would have to stay there for at least 3 weeks. But as soon as we arrived, we were separated, male and female and children, and more or less stripped. We had to strip naked to be examined by a doctor. And then, of course, straight away go and see somebody to find a job or arrange for something or some kind of education. But I soon discovered that I wasn't able to finish my medical studies because, of course, my father, having lost everything, wasn't able to pay for it, and the Swiss government was only prepared to give me a short course in a commercial college for 6 months if I wanted to, which I accepted. And I lived in a very nice, actually beautiful hotel in Lucerne, which was taken over as, we call them Rückwandererheim, in other words, for the emigrants who had come back into Switzerland. And for 6 months, I took a course of shorthand and typing, and then I was able to get a job. Now, my father had greatest difficulty in getting a job because he had no certificate. When you own your own business, you don't have a certificate to say, I can do this and that. In any case, Switzerland is the country for cheese and butter and so on, and that was his trade. Mm. They didn't want him. But he found a part-time job in a hotel in the accounts department, and my mother, being very good at shorthand and typing, got a full-time job, so they could start again with a flat. And then the Swiss government was quite good. They gave us a lump sum to buy furniture and to start ourselves off. I took a job in an office so I could contribute with some money living with my parents. My sister was apprenticed at the local hospital. She wanted to learn the laboratory work. But my elder sister with her baby had to go into a different home, of course. And I didn't like the job and the office, so I changed and went into a hotel, very small hotel in Hergeswil near Lucerne, and that's where I met my future husband.
Is that where you first learned your English as well?
No, I learned English at school. And I had to use it in the hotel, but I found it wasn't good enough. So I thought, right, I'm going to try and go to England to learn English. And I knew that au pair girls were accepted in England. I got applied for a permit in a children's home in Hemel Hempstead. Actually, the matron came to the hotel and offered me the job. Mm. And I've got a very nice, my permit in the second book, because it's rather hilarious the way it sort of is, what it looks like today after all this time. So I thought, well, this ought to be produced in the book.
What was your first reaction to England when you arrived?
Well, England reminded me a lot of Germany. It was so destroyed because, you see, I came so quickly after the war. And of course, it was rationing was still going on in Switzerland. You see, we had food and everything was very beautiful. But I had only a very short spell before again I was made aware of what the war had done to people. I liked England because I found people were more understanding than the Swiss people. You see, Swiss people never had a war. And Rückwander, you know, the emigrants weren't treated all that well. But in England, although I didn't speak a lot of English at first, they were kind, and particularly in a children's home, the children tried to help you. And having met my husband already in Switzerland, I was in this children's home in Hemel Hempstead, and he lived in Great Missenden, or not far from Great Missenden, so he used to come and see me every Sunday, and I fell in love, and a year later we got married.
How did you meet him then? Was it fairly romantic?
It was very romantic, yes. I don't know whether I ought to tell you that, you ought to read it in the book, but it was romantic. Very romantic, because first of all, when he arrived in the hotel, he arrived with his sister, and it was my job to allocate the rooms, but I had given a list that they were Mr. and Mrs., so I gave them a double room. Mm. So straight away there was a bit of a commotion when I saw the passports. I had to sort of rearrange rooms, everybody had to wait, and I don't think they liked that very much, but it wasn't my fault. But I really, so of course I knew what he looked like, but we had fancy dress party, and I wasn't supposed to go to the fancy dress party because staff wasn't allowed, but the chef in the kitchen was cross about, and he said, we're all going to dress as ghosts with white hats on and sort of holes on the end to look through. And we rode out to the lake and came in as ghosts and picked a partner to dance, and of course I picked Bob. And the next morning he came to the office and he said, I did recognize you, you know, and we had a lovely time last night, although I didn't tell him who I was because of the being a ghost. He recognized me on my watch, because apparently he repairs watches and clocks, so my arms were sticking out under the sheets, you see, and so of course he recognized it. Then we got married a year later, and I thought this will now be the end of all my troubles, but it wasn't, because my eldest boy was born with cerebral palsy, and I had quite a fight to give him the type of education which I felt he deserved, because when he was 18 months old, they were going to put him into a home. They said he would never walk or talk, but I knew that there was intelligence there, and I had to fight the authorities to permit me to go to different places. And I found Mrs. Collis, a physiotherapist who had cerebral palsy unit in Queen Mary's Hospital, Carshalton. She taught me to show Victor how he eventually could move his legs, and in the end she took him even into the hospital for 6 months. And because I had done these exercises for years, every day with him, she got him onto his legs. Mm. And he started to walk. I then got him into a very special school run by the Spastic Society, the only spastic grammar school in the country. And Victor really went ahead after that, except he had to have a great number of operations when he was 14 years old. And that was in Sheffield, the Rivlin Valley. He was for a long time there. We used to go and visit him every weekend. But things worked out right for him. And I like this message, really, to go to all people who have got handicapped children. Don't give up. There's an awful lot you can do. And go and push and go yourself. I went everywhere myself. I even went to get a wheelchair for him because I wanted one that was light for me to lift in and out. I went to see the schools and persuaded them to take my son. And I can say that today he is a computer expert. So he really has achieved something. But you've got to help yourself.
You've achieved a great deal over the years as well. Great courage, great will. I think it was when you'd actually gone through all of that problematic time with your son, it was then you decided to start studying all over again. You became a teacher, I think.
Yes, I did that too. I took a 2 years full-time teaching course because I wanted to achieve something with some kind of a certificate. And I passed that. And in the end, I qualified myself in dressmaking and gents tailoring. I'm a Savile Row tailoress even. And I taught at Oxford College. We had tremendous fashion shows in the town hall, and I started actually the fashion show for gents. We made gents suits, evening suits, and my husband and my second son were my two models, and it became quite successful. And that was something which I enjoyed. That was something which I felt I achieved myself. I had at last some kind of education with a qualification at the end, which I missed out because I never finished my medical studies.
Now, anybody who's been listening to this will know right away that you're an excellent storyteller. But where did the inspiration for the book come from? Did you suddenly decide to write it, or did somebody say, look, you've got to put this into writing?
Yes. Now, that was my two sons and my husband, because, you see, what I wrote in the first book about being a refugee, I never talked about it, because the Russians were very, very cruel. And on my trip, I had a small vial of cyanide around my neck in case the Russians got hold of me. And I couldn't talk about it, but my sons always said, we'd like to know. So could you write it? And when you have written it, we will keep it. Mm. We won't even look at it. But of course, they did look at it. And then they said, that's got to be published. You really got to tell the world this story in English. So I did. And of course, once the first book was finished and people asked me what happened after that.
The new book is out now. It's published by Verona. It's called Helga the Continuing Story, and it's priced at $7.99. And I can tell you, if you've been fascinated by what you've heard so far, then the book is well worth buying. But I have to say as well that if you haven't read either of them, it's probably a good idea to buy both, isn't it?
Yes, I think the first one gives more detailed explanations, although the second one has a short synopsis in the first part. But, of course, you can't have the details. It's only just to lead you in to the second part.
And does this book now bring you right up to date? Is there another one perhaps in the pipeline?
Well, it brings it right up to our 25th wedding anniversary. And I think after that, things smoothed out and both my sons are married. Even the one with cerebral palsy has got two sons. The eldest one is already 18 years old and they're both very healthy children, very clever. And I'm quite happy.
Good. I know that you've had serious back trouble all of your life as well. That's also been corrected recently, hasn't it?
Yes. Well, that was because I carried Victor until he was 8. Then he started to walk. And then he had the different operations when he was 14. So I had to carry him again. And, of course, at 14 he was quite a weight. And I'm afraid that ruined my back. Yes, I had an operation. And I won't lift anything. And I'm very careful. But it's all right.
Good. Well, it's been excellent talking to you. Helga, thank you very much for joining us in the studio today. And I would recommend this book and the original book to anybody who's interested. Again, the publishers are Verona, £7.99, which is a bargain for the second book. And the piece I'm particularly wanting to read about is how you met Bob, because judging by the smirk that he gave me when you were going through the story, I think there's more of a story to be told there.
Yes, I think you're right.
Helga Gerhardy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.